It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. 9 days after the fatal shooting of Renee Good by a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent in Minneapolis, a border community in Wisconsin feels on edge.
Minnesota Governor Tim Walz is asking President Trump to, quote, turn the temperature down after his threat to deploy military forces to Minneapolis if state officials don't stop protests against ICE raids.
With escalating tensions in Minneapolis between protesters and ICE agents, we turn our attention to Eau Claire in western Wisconsin to find out how that community is feeling. The Eau Claire County Sheriff confirmed last Monday, January 5th, that ICE agents were sighted within Eau Claire and at its courthouse.
Emily Berge is Eau Claire City Council President. Emily, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Your county, Eau Claire County, Chippewa Valley, close to Minneapolis. What is it like in your community since the fatal shooting of Renee Good?
Well, Minneapolis, we have a lot of people with connections from Minnesota, Minneapolis. I talked to several people that have their adult children live in that same neighborhood. So, you know, we're only about an hour and a half away. So we are on edge. I think that's a good description. It feels a bit like a pressure cooker over here. And then just watching, you know, the killing of Renee and then the protests and then our own confirmed sightings of ICE in our county is just, it's a lot. And I just always think about the most vulnerable in our community and people don't feel safe right now.
Can we talk further about that sightings of ICE in your community? The Eau Claire County Sheriff, the department confirmed to us last week about ICE presence in the county. Do you have any updates to share? What have you learned?
I don't have a lot of updates to share. There's not a lot, you know, there ICE is not talking with our local police and our local police aren't talking with ICE. So they're kind of just doing their own thing. And it's really just if people happen to see their cars or trucks or whatever they're driving or them doing their actions. So it's just kind of through word of mouth right now because there's no real official communication.
Emily, you know, Eau Claire has this vibrant Hmong community, yeah. Latino population. What has been the yeah. impact on local communities of color?
They're feeling unsafe, you know, not to speak for them, but I do have relationships in the community and they're feeling unsafe that they have to, even though they're American citizens, you know, they have to bring their documents with them, their passports or ID with them when they leave the house, even, you know, to walk their dog or bring their kids to school. And it's just that extra step, that extra thing that they always have to think about that me as a white person doesn't have to think about. And so it's just people are just worried about their family members, their neighbors. And it's just a scary time for a lot of folks.
You've talked about how people in Eau Claire, I mean, they go to the airport, they shop, they eat, yeah. they do business in Minnesota and Minneapolis area. Do you think, will Eau Claire residents perhaps avoid going to the Twin Cities during this tense time with ICE activity and protests?
I think some probably will. And I think some are, you know, there's a lot of helpers in our community throughout the whole country. And I think people, if they think it'll be helpful, they would go. But I think people are fearful, yes, as well, and will avoid the area. And a lot of people don't like chaos. We don't feel safe when it's chaotic, and people will avoid it. But we do love Minneapolis, and we're standing with them, and the immigrant community, just like here in Eau Claire too. I'm very clear in that all are welcome in Eau Claire, no matter where you're from.
Emily, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Have a good day.
You too. We've been talking about ICE activity in Wisconsin and neighboring Minnesota with Eau Claire City Council President Emily Berge. Now to talk about the rights that immigrants in Minnesota and Wisconsin have, we turn to Mark Christopher, an immigration attorney with offices in Appleton and Milwaukee. He has been representing some of the hundreds of Haitian immigrants in his community who have lost their legal refugee status. Mark, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you. Good morning.
Do your immigrant clients have fears after seeing what is transpiring in Minneapolis with ICE raids and protesters? What do you hear?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Everybody is terrified. They see what's been broadcast on TV. They see the indiscriminate arrest of people. They see ICE going door to door. And so the level of fear and anxiety in our immigrant community is off the charts.
Have you learned of ICE activity where you are? Are you hearing other reports around Wisconsin? What do you know?
As of right now, I haven't seen a huge influx or increase of what I would call ICE being in our streets and detaining people that way. I have seen an increase of ICE detaining individuals who may be in our local jails, who may have been arrested, even if on very minor offenses like driving without a license. But as far as this indiscriminate going around door to door in Wisconsin, not yet.
There is so much legal complexity and confusion over jurisdiction among law enforcement agencies and whether ICE agents at a scene are, you know, acting within their authority. And I'm wondering, the Trump administration sending large numbers of ICE agents to Minnesota, what rights do immigrants have against these enforcement policies and tactics?
Yeah, what I tell everybody is, when you're out on the street, you're walking on the sidewalk, you're at a store, you are never, ever required to give a law enforcement officer your immigration status, where you were born, if you're on a visa. Not in one instance are you required to do that. So by simply knowing that simple right and utilizing it, it can go a long way.
How do these rights compare to what we're seeing playing out on the ground with ICE agents? I mean, we've seen federal agents toss tear gas at protesters. We've seen someone, you know, being dragged out of their car. What is your assessment?
Yeah, well, I think what they're relying on, what ICE is relying on, is a culture of fear. And when they go up to an individual and, you know, maybe they speak a different language or they look different, if they go up and ask them, are you here without status? Were you born in the U.S.? Or are you a U.S. citizen? If they say no, a lot of times people see law enforcement and they want to comply. They want to answer. They don't want to lie. So they say, no, I don't have it. Then at that point, they're able to detain and inquire more. Now, as far as them, you know, the tear gas at the protesters, it's just an unfortunate thing that's going on. I think a lot of the ICE officers that are out there right now are relatively new on the streets. They don't have a lot of experience. From my understanding, there's not a lot of vetting and training of the officers. And so I think when you have that situation, you have high tensions, you run into situations like we're seeing in Minneapolis.
As an attorney, do you have concerns about due process as you see how ICE is conducting its raids and conducting its arrests?
Absolutely. And in so many different ways. As an attorney, once somebody is detained by ICE, sometimes it's nearly impossible for me to even have any communication with them. What we're seeing is, let's say somebody is arrested in Wisconsin. 3 days later, they're in Louisiana, in an ICE detention center in Louisiana or Kentucky. And it takes me at least a week to arrange for an attorney conference call. So my ability to speak with them is very limited. They're not given what their rights are by ICE officers. And sometimes they're being swept away without ever me having an opportunity to speak with them. So, yeah, very much so am I concerned about due process.
Are there enough of you? Are there enough immigration attorneys to assist in these cases?
Yeah, candidly, no. No, there aren't. And it's a very complex area of law. It's a very nuanced area of law. And it's very difficult, both from the standpoint emotionally of dealing with these situations, understanding families are going to be separated, knowing what the consequences are. But also from just a logistical standpoint, once somebody's taken by ICE, it takes me an hour or two to even figure out where they are. Then I have to arrange some type of attorney conference call with that specific jail. So it's very time consuming. It's very emotionally taxing. But I guess the short answer to your question is no, there aren't a lot of attorneys out here who are able to do this type of work.
When we talked earlier this summer, I mean, there were concerns about clients showing up at the courthouse and possibly, you know, for their proceedings and fearing being arrested or taken away by ICE. Are those feelings still concerns of your clients?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And there, not only is that there, but since we talked in the summer, the ability for individuals to apply for asylum has been essentially stripped. So if you've come into the United States in the last like 4 or 5 years, there's a new agreement in place whereby if you're applying for asylum, they're saying, no, you can't do it here in the United States because we've entered into a third-party agreement with a different country. It could be a country in Africa. It could be Honduras. It could be, you know, one of a number of different countries. So you don't even get to have your asylum hearing here in the United States. You have to go to a third country now.
You would have to have so much money to do that.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's asylum is an extremely, extremely time intensive type of case for an immigration attorney. It's not a cookie cutter case. So you have to spend time with the individual. You have to spend time with their family. And you do all of that. And now all of a sudden you're being told, well, you don't even get the opportunity to go in front of a judge here in the U.S. You have to do it now in a third country.
If a loved one is taken to an ICE detention facility here in Wisconsin or elsewhere, what should they do? What should their loved ones do?
Yeah, the most important thing initially is to properly prepare. Make sure that you have all of your documents, birth certificates of your children, marriage certificates. Also have an attorney ready to go. You know, at least go in and talk to someone where you can tell them what your background and your situation is. So if that person is detained, if they are detained here in Wisconsin, they're almost always processed through the Milwaukee ICE office. Once they're there, they get what's called an alien number. It's a 9-digit number. And once you have that number, if you pass that along to the attorney, that attorney then can try to locate them within the ICE systems. So, you know, making sure that you've got your documents, making sure you know your situation, making sure that you have an attorney, and then making sure you get your alien number. Those are all very important things to do.
Mark, thank you so much for this conversation. Thank you for taking the time.
Oh, it's always my pleasure. Thank you.
Mark Christopher is an immigration attorney with offices in Appleton and Milwaukee. And we previously spoke with Emily Berge, Eau Claire's city council president. We've been talking about ICE activity in Wisconsin and neighboring Minnesota and how communities are responding.
Up, there's a shortage of fire trucks and costs are going up. That has some Wisconsin departments waiting and trying to get more life out of old equipment.
It's a problem. Are we going to be able to find parts when the truck is 30, 35 years old to keep it running, or are we going to have to bite the proverbial bullet and purchase a new vehicle at that time?
Two fire chiefs join the show next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin fire departments are facing disruptions and delays because of a nationwide shortage of fire trucks.
As fire officials across the state look to replace their aging fleets, they're experiencing delays in their orders that take multiple years and can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars.
That's prompting some departments to order even further in advance of their needs, while others are left still waiting for trucks they ordered years ago.
Last year, the city of La Crosse filed a class action lawsuit in federal court against three fire truck manufacturers, accusing them of coordinating to limit the supply and raise prices.
Two of the three companies being sued are based in the state. In public statements, the companies have blamed delays and cost increases on supply and logistics problems, as well as the rise in demand.
We're checking in now with two Wisconsin fire chiefs to find out how they're navigating that shortage and working around it. Walter Leininger is fire chief for the Caledonia Fire Department in southeast Wisconsin. Chief Leininger, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
All right. Can you take us through the early stages of your attempt to order a new truck, a new fire truck for your department?
Sure. So we are replacing some equipment that's about 20, at the time it was about 23 years old, 24 years old. And we've put out to bid several builders, one of them being Ewan, one of them being Pierce. We made a purchase back in October of 2023 for a pumper fire engine. Real basic, nothing special about this piece of equipment. It's replacing a piece of equipment that's about what's now about 25 years old. We were told at the time that we were bidding out this that it could take up to about 3 years to get it, which we thought was kind of odd. Our last engine that we purchased in 2016 was a total custom piece, and it took about 11 months to get in. At the end of the day, after the contract was signed, fine print said it could take up to 46 months to get this piece of equipment in.
And now here we are, early days of 2026. If I understand things correctly, you do not have this truck at this point.
No, we don't have the truck. I was told that the RFP went out at the end of October, and the anticipated date is about 18 months from that RFP.
Now, this all started in 2023. It took 11 months on your previous truck. Are you getting any indication of why this particular truck is taking so long to turn around?
Initially, we're told just supply, recouping from, you know, the COVID and supply and demand, manufacturers making different parts. They're just behind supplies, materials. But it seemed somewhat legitimate at the time. You know, after COVID, a lot of stuff had changed during COVID. A lot of businesses closed down. There was a hard time to get some, you know, work supplies here for the fire department. At the time, it seemed like it was probably just maybe this is just going to be a rebound. They told us initially 36 months, you know, they'll get back in the groove. Manufacturers will be swinging full force pretty soon. And maybe we'll have this truck before then.
I assume you're in touch with colleagues around the state, other fire chiefs. Are you hearing similar stories? Is this just a tough time for everybody to try to get new equipment?
We were in contact, I think, with somebody, I think Paris. We know some people in Paris. And we shared our story with some of their members. And I think they're on year five, maybe, for getting their, it's almost like a snorkel. So that was just recently. We really didn't have a lot of input or we knew it was going to take some time. But when the lawsuit started coming out of Upper Wisconsin, and then we seen the congressional hearing, it kind of, hey, what really is going on here moment? What is going on with these fire trucks? What they're claiming, is there some merit to what they're saying? Is this true that they're starting to hike prices and play supply and demand games as to why we're not getting our truck and why our truck is $812,000 when, you know, just a few years ago it was $550,000 for our total custom pump?
Now, I want to talk about what this means for your department. You said this is, 25 years old now, the piece of equipment you're replacing. You know, if we think about our cars, 25 years would be a pretty good lifespan, maybe stretching it for a lot of our personal vehicles. What kind of concerns do you have having this key piece of equipment at that quarter century mark?
Well, it's a collector's piece, I'll tell you. It's hard to find parts for it. Some parts you have to get off of places like eBay. Other parts they don't make anymore. You have to figure out how to adapt certain things. The piece of equipment that is going out the door will have over 180,000 miles on it. You know, it'll be 25 years old. It becomes a question as how much more starts is it going to have? How many more pumps is it going to have? You know, it gets more costly to keep these things up and running to the standard. And it gets hard to find parts for it, or even people who know how to work on it. It becomes an unreliable piece for the community. It becomes more of a liability. It's almost a gamble. If I got to use this oldest piece that I have for frontline, it becomes I don't want to say cross your fingers, but it becomes okay, let's hurry up and get this other piece, you know, the primary rig back so I can put this back in reserve and we'll check on when our new rig is supposed to be here, you know, kind of moment. So it's not a good time.
I wanted to ask about that backup question, because if I'm, you know, a really big city fire department, say, and one of my units is old and maybe not that reliable, well, it's not great, but I've got, you know, other pieces of equipment that can cover it. How much, depth do you have at this position, if I can use a football term, to where having this one piece not be reliable is a big problem?
So to keep these vehicles running daily basis on emergency runs, they have to go through preventive maintenance, which means they got to come out of service occasionally for oil changes, brake checks, light fixes, pump packing checks, you know, replace valves, just normal wear and tear. And, you know, we have on our organization, we have three engines, Quint tenders. So when I take one of these out, it's this reserve piece that is the oldest that I got to put in frontline. Now, my second piece is 24 years old. Knock on wood, it seems to be doing okay. It doesn't get the amount of mileage that some of these other vehicles get, but it is still 24 years old, and it has the same problems as the others: parts, reliability, people who know how to work on this particular piece of equipment. So it becomes, it's not so much how much deep I can go. It is more of at what point is the last straw going to break on this stuff.
I wanted to ask about that maintenance issue, because we can all think about our vehicles and things that could go wrong and things that you could fix on them. Those are all there for a fire truck, and there's the fire truck part of what it does. How much specialized care does a fire department vehicle need as opposed to, you know, my car?
Well, I would say it takes more care. Vehicles that you drive to work back and forth are probably more reliable mile per mile than a fire engine is. You know, you take a 78,000 pound rig out, you go from 0 to 60 out the door, you're pretty much gunning it. There's no warm up, and you need to get down to where you're going in a timely manner. You're not speeding per se, but you're on the throttle. It takes a lot of wear and tear. 78,000 pounds going down your typical street. You look at Wisconsin roads, there's a lot of pounding there with, especially in this winter season, a lot of road bumps and potholes, all that stuff takes wear and tear. You add 78,000 pounds to a vehicle, that's even more. These aren't vehicles that are made to last, or I would say last, but to have 250,000 miles on them. They're not really made to go that long. They're made to do these short burst runs, go to the fire, pump hard at all weather conditions, drive back, they get cleaned up, they get some maintenance, but they're kind of like the street version of a construction vehicle. They're built tough, but they're not made to go hundreds and hundreds of thousands of miles, and they need a lot of repair.
Chief Leidinger, as we wrap up, are you concerned if this is the norm in a lot of departments where you're using equipment that's kind of past its lifespan? Is there a public safety concern here?
Yes, there is. If I can't get equipment replaced in a more timely manner, I'm going to have unreliable equipment. And it's going to force me to kind of make decisions on, do I refurbish a piece of equipment that is 15, 20 years old? Can I put a rebuild the engine and a transmission and a pump and maybe put a new chassis on there and put some paint on it? It's still the same rig, same VIN. Is it going to be as reliable? I don't know. Is it going to have the same safety features as a brand new vehicle? Probably not. It becomes a safety concern for the public if we're going to be able to reach them. If we get equipment that's 20, 25 years old, it's got 180,000 miles on it. It's kind of taking a gamble there when you start getting equipment that old.
Chief Leidinger, thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Walter Leidinger is the fire chief for the Caledonia Fire Department in southeast Wisconsin, with us today to share how his fire department is working through delays because of a nationwide fire truck shortage. Now we turn our attention to another Wisconsin fire department that's looking at alternative options to work around the shortage of new trucks. Steve Hansen is fire chief for the Racine Fire Department. Chief Hansen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me today. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you.
All right. In Racine, what is the age of the equipment we're talking about here, the fire trucks that you are working with?
In Racine, we've been able to pretty much keep up with our maintenance. A lot like our colleague in Caledonia, we have a set replacement schedule for our apparatus. In 2023, we did replace two of our pumpers with two new pumpers at a cost of about $525,000 apiece. But we are coming up on replacing two additional pumpers down the road here. We have one due up in 2028 and another one due up in 2030. And both those trucks will be 20 years old on those anniversaries. So we do have some apparatus coming up down the road here. But the other thing also is it's not only fire trucks. We also have challenges with our ambulances. We're in the process of replacing two of our ambulances, and we just recently learned that the anticipated delivery on those ambulances is 900 days out, or about 2.5 years. So a very similar issue with the ambulances as with the fire trucks, where there is becoming long lead times to take delivery on these vehicles.
And we just heard from Chief Leidinger in Caledonia, you know, that option is out there. Hey, maybe can we refurbish this equipment instead of replacing it now? Is that something you've been exploring in Racine?
Absolutely. Refurbishing is definitely on the table. As Chief Leidinger had pointed out, you know, as these trucks get older, they become harder to maintain. But the other issue that we also experience with all these vehicles is corrosion and rust, which impacts all the different systems that are on these trucks. Everything from electrical wiring to cabinets start to corrode and become problematic as time goes on. So one of the things that we did was we did retire, or I should say we put in reserve status, a 2003 pumper. Late last year, I had approached the city about the possibility of testing refurbishing instead of buying new. So at the present time, we have a pumper that's out for refurbishment at about the quarter of the cost of a new pumper. Now, we did get estimates on our two pumpers that we have to replace in 2028 and 2030, and they're right around $1 million apiece. And there was a couple of bids, informal bids that we got on those. So we know that that's expensive, and we know that's a significant burden to our taxpayers. So at the present time, we're exploring refurbishing one of our trucks. It's out right now. And basically what they do is they disassemble the entire truck, look for all the things that have gone past their useful life, looking for corrosion, for wiring problems and things like that. They'll fix all of that, and then they will reassemble that vehicle. We anticipate getting that vehicle back in the next 2 months, at which time we're going to put it through its paces, testing the mechanical systems, testing the pump, making sure that it performs up to National Fire Protection Association standards, which is what we all go by. And if that is successful, then we would potentially look at refurbishing the two trucks that are due up in 28 and 30 as well.
Chief Leininger had mentioned difficulties with the older pumper truck of, you know, finding parts at people who know how to work on this particular type of equipment. Was that a challenge for refurbishing, making sure you're going to be able to replace parts that need replacing and having the right skills to do this pretty specialized work?
Absolutely. As Chief Leininger had pointed out, you know, as these pieces of equipment age, it becomes harder and harder to get some of the replacement parts. We're fortunate here in Racine, and I know all departments can't do this, but we have our own internal mechanics on the department. We have two individuals, a civilian master mechanic, and then one of our firefighters who's also a master mechanic that help us with our repairs. And these are folks that have been trained to work on heavy equipment and keep our equipment in good running order. But it is a problem that we have to be cognizant of, because even with refurbishing, we might get another 10 or 15 years out of that vehicle, but now we're looking at a vehicle that may be 30, 35 years old, and will we be able to get parts down the road? You know, for perhaps a starter goes out or packings go out on a pump. You know, are those going to be available? And that's something we're watching very closely with this refurbishment. Once we get this vehicle back, we'll have a couple of years to evaluate that. The other side of the coin that we do, and I know all departments don't have capability, is we do stock certain expendable parts that we know are typically going to fail at some point in the truck's life. In Racine here, we see broken leaf springs, so we keep those in stock. We do keep some alternators in stock, starters, and things like that. But there also needs to be a recognition that not every department has that ability or capability to do that. We've been fortunate to be able to do that here. But yes, it's a problem. Are we going to be able to find parts when the truck is 30, 35 years old to keep it running? Or are we going to have to bite the proverbial bullet and purchase a new vehicle at that time? So yes, it's definitely a concern.
And then for buying new vehicles, you mentioned you've got target timelines of 2028, you'd need a replacement, and 2030. Well, hearing from Chief Leininger and what you're saying about the timing, what, that first one would have to, the order would have to be in now to have a shot of getting it in 2028. How hard is it to plan ahead and try to get on the schedule when it's taking 2, 3, 4 years to turn around these orders?
Well, in the city of Racine here, we do a 10-year capital improvement plan, and I update that plan every year. So replacing those two trucks in 2028 and 2030 are already in the capital improvement plan, so we know that that's there. The challenge is the delivery time frame. Again, once we get this refurbished truck back, it'll give us a clearer picture on whether we need to order new trucks, knowing that it may take 3 to 4 years to accept delivery, or do we look at refurbishing? Refurbishing, obviously, is only going to take 6 to 9 months as opposed to 4 years for a new truck. Now, having said that, I am aware that there are issues with some of the truck manufacturers where there are supply chain issues. Sometimes parts are hard to get by. Skilled labor to assemble these vehicles because they are specialized and they require special skills to put them together. That all comes into play. And obviously that's on the manufacturer's end, but it does trickle down to us. Now, having said all of that as well, as Chief Langinger had pointed out, we're anticipating that if we have to buy new, we are looking at about $1 million to $1.25 million per truck in 2028 and 2030. So that's a huge expense.
Just out of curiosity, you know, I think about a car you could buy now versus one you'd buy 25 years ago. Now they're basically, you know, computers with cars attached to them. How much has fire truck technology changed since these older units that are ready to retire are going away?
Technology has changed tremendously. I do own an antique fire engine that was built in 1923 that I maintain. It's simply a lot easier to take care of that truck than it is the trucks nowadays. I know our new pumpers that we got in 2023, the two engines we bought then, they have 14 separate computers on board, and that doesn't include the master control module that controls the motor, what we call the ECM. But these computers, they're all together to perform different functions, to provide different monitoring capabilities of the different systems that they're installing on these trucks.
Chief Hansen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having us. I really appreciate your time.
Steve Hansen is fire chief for the Racine Fire Department. He was with us today to share his department's efforts to refurbish fire trucks amid a nationwide shortage of new ones. Earlier, we heard from Caledonia Fire Chief Walter Leininger about how his department has faced multi-year delays for a fire truck they ordered.
Up, a cherished Milwaukee Arts Center hosts a poetry marathon raising funds for Woodland Pattern. Decades ago, Wisconsin's poet laureate found a home there.
It's really a wonderful community space. It draws people together in community. You know, I've gotten to know so many wonderful friends there.
Hundreds of poets building up Milwaukee's Woodland Pattern. That's next. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about Wisconsin's bar culture.
In Wisconsin, for better or worse, drinking can be more than a pastime. It's a social ritual woven into the state's culture. Writer Patty C. takes us on a bar crawl to explore how Wisconsin's humble taverns shaped our history and built community.
I recently went on my fifth, almost annual, Cousins Tavern tour. Our theme was neighborhood bars. Without a beer sign in the window, the establishment might as well blend in as another house on the block. Bobby Schradel's mother and mine were sisters. He and his wife Connie lived just down the highway from my husband and me and picked us up on a 90-degree afternoon for our first stop, Burley's in Chippewa Falls. The four of us step into the cool air of that dark bar and never want to leave. In 1997, Brian Krista bought what was once The Mint, then Pepe's, and called it by his nickname. Burley tells us the history of the wooden back bar, an intricate beauty that was stained mahogany to cover up damage from a fire long before any of us was born. For Burley's 20th anniversary here, his buddy gifted him an enormous fiberglass fish head bought on eBay. It's been mounted on the wall for 5 years. Burley isn't sure who put the little rubber ducky in its mouth or when. Next is Raleigh's Coach Club in Altoona, owned by Raleigh Nusala since 1986. Happy Hour attracts 20-somethings in scrubs and 80-somethings in beauty parlor curls. A round of drinks costs us $10. We play Shake-A-Day, and Connie carries home a six-pack. We're old. This summer, we can only make 3 stops in a day. Our final, Amber Inn, the longest-running bar in Eau Claire. It was built in 1881 by Walter's Brewery to sell their product. 100 years later, Orv and Pat Johnson bought the place. Included in the sale was a 1910 photo of patrons posing on the sidewalk out front. A surprise in the crowd, Orv's grandfather. The Johnsons have run Amber Inn the past 44 years. Their current slogan, "You're a stranger here but once," has a timeless feel, which might have appealed to barflies in the last two centuries. We order fish and burgers, sip our ice-cold beer, and watch Orv fry our food in a prep area about the size of my kitchen counter. The menu claims that galley space is where all the magic happens. The cheese curds are so spectacular that even my chatty cousins finally stop talking. Edward Slingerland, author of Drunk, How We Sipped, Danced, and Stumbled Our Way to Civilization, claims that 3,000 years before organized agriculture, hunter-gatherers came together not to break bread, but to brew beer. From an evolutionary standpoint, alcohol helped aggressive, untrusting primates build cooperative and successful societies. In that regard, Slingerland says intoxication is part of the story of what makes us human. Wisconsinites' relationship with drinking is complicated. Having a few beers together builds camaraderie, decreases inhibitions, and increases a flow state for creativity. Turns out, it's also a part of our biological history. This cheap, socially acceptable drug makes intoxication the basis of what Slingerland calls the economy of human desires. Or as Amber Inn advertises, "Go ahead, have a couple. You'll feel better."
Patty C. is a writer from Lake Halley. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Sarah Hopeful.
This is WPR News.
Milwaukee's artist-run book center and performance space called Woodland Pattern is set to host its 32nd annual poetry marathon and benefit this month.
For two 12-hour days, hundreds of poets will gather in Milwaukee to share their own works and those of other poets.
For Wisconsin's poet laureate Brenda Cardenas, Woodland Pattern holds a very special place in her heart. She's attended programs there since she was a teenager.
And it's where decades ago she met another poet, Roberto Harrison, who would become her spouse.
They are involved in curating this year's poetry marathon, and Brenda serves as secretary of the board of directors of Woodland Pattern.
And they join us now from Milwaukee to talk about their life making poetry and supporting Woodland Pattern's mission. Brenda and Roberto, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thank you very much for having us.
Brenda, you've attended programs at Woodland Pattern for over 45 years. What draws you to this creative space?
Well, so many things. First of all, it's really a wonderful community space. It draws people together in community. And, you know, I've gotten to know so many wonderful friends there. But also, it's the variety of their programming. They're not about one single aesthetic. So they bring in poets and writers from all over the country and even internationally who all have different kinds of poetry, different styles, just different aesthetics. They bring in fiction writers sometimes, essayists. They'll have like whole panels with publishers, a particular small press publisher, for example, might do a whole panel or a couple days worth of stuff. They have workshops, writing workshops, and they also deal with the other arts as well. Certainly, they specialize and focus on the literary arts, but they do a lot with the visual arts, with film, with music, in particular, experimental music and other kinds of music that you wouldn't probably find almost anywhere else, right? With the exception of a few places. So there's so much there. Yeah.
Yeah. Brenda, can you share the story about how you first met Roberto at Woodland Pattern decades ago and what happened?
Yeah, that's a special story that we've shared many times. I had just moved back to Milwaukee after living in Chicago for it was either 8 or 9 years. I was in Chicago, and then I was in Ann Arbor, Michigan, I think for 5 years before that. So I had been away from Milwaukee. And, you know, Chicago has a very lively literary scene as well. And so when I first moved back, I was really missing Chicago and my friends there. And one of my friends, the poet Daniel Berzutsky, called and he said, you know, we're coming down from Chicago for a big reading at Woodland Pattern tonight. And it's going to be these two famous poets from New York. And then he said, a friend of mine is opening for them. Why don't you meet us for dinner and let's go to the reading and then you can get back into life in Milwaukee, right? And so, because I was really missing Chicago. And we did that and we walked into Woodland Pattern and lo and behold, this friend, Daniel, happened to know Roberto as well through different channels. And Roberto was standing in the poetry section and of Woodland Pattern. And I walked in with Daniel and they said, hey, and they went to give each other a hug. And I walked behind Daniel and then Daniel introduced me to Roberto. And Roberto said, what are you doing here in Milwaukee? And I said, I'm missing Chicago. And then we talked a little bit and Roberto was the poet who was opening for... it was the Waldrops, Rosemarie Waldrop, and is it Ken?
And Keith.
Ken, is it,
and
what's
Keith
this?
Waldrop.
Keith. Yeah, Keith. And Roberto was the poet opening.
Roberto, what do you remember about this chance meeting and seeing Brenda for the first time?
Yeah, I remember exactly where we were standing. We were standing in the poetry section right next to the chapbooks, and... I remember seeing Brenda from across the room and, you know, kind of checking her out. And and I gave my reading. And then afterwards, I met Brenda and her friends. And that was the beginning.
Mm. Fast forward to today. You're both involved in curating Hours of the Poetry Marathon. Brenda, you're reading in the Wisconsin Poet Laureate Commission Hour. Can you give us a little hint what's in store?
So it'll be poets laureate, present and past, right? Some who've been a Wisconsin poet laureate and some who've been poets laureate of different cities in Wisconsin. And so I can't remember exactly who is all on it. I know, I'm almost positive, Angie Trudell-Vasquez, who was recently poet laureate of Madison, is one of the people reading, and a whole bunch of others. Mm-hmm. And it's just each person in the marathon only reads for 5 minutes. You don't ever have one voice going on too long. And the time is very strict, right? Because they don't want to have to bump anybody. So you hear somebody read for 5 minutes, whether that's like two little tiny poems or one little bit longer poem. And then you hear the next one and the next one. And each hour has about 10 readers. Some hours might have only 8 or something like that, but for the majority of them, it's about 10 readers. So that's what will happen in that hour. It will be all laureates.
Oh, what a great community to be a part of. And Roberto, you and Brenda are curating the Latinx Poetry Hour together. Can you talk about a little bit about what you're putting together?
Yeah, the poets that we're featuring this year include Mauricio Kilwain Guevara, who's our Brendan Neighbor, Jackie Valadez, who's a young poet living here in Milwaukee. I'll be reading. And then Lucy Christina Chalcali will be reading from Panama. Parid Matuk will be reading. Sandra Ruiz, Paul Martinez Pompa from Chicago. J. Michael Martinez, Carolina Abid, I think that's how they say her name. Christina Vega Westhoff and Roque Raquel Salas Rivera. So these are all really interesting poets. And, you know, it's always a great hour.
And a few will be live and many of them live elsewhere. So they will have the little pre-recorded videos that will show, but in the same room, right? On a big, great big screen.
Oh, wow. Roberto, I understand you brought along a special poem that you read to Brenda at your wedding celebration. Could you share it with us?
Sure. I read it at the celebration at Woodland Pattern the day after our wedding. So here it is for Brenda. Oh, we had gone to the Grand Canyon together, me and Brenda, and it was a great trip. And this is what I wrote. I just called the Grand Canyon and had them reserve two mules for us. They said that if I'm with a girl with a shiny smile, I'd have to surround the perimeter of the canyon with mirrors so as to allow the people there to collect the solar energy beaming from that smile. They said that if her smile is beautiful, I would have to wait 10,000 years before the drawings on the canyon walls, the result of the people's profound love for her face, will fade enough for me to walk into the horizon with her love in my arms. They said that I would be with her like the earth is with the canyon walls, though pictures make a memory of us. They said the eagles will hide in her hair and give me their wings to fly off with her again to the moon. They said the stars will swell her face with eyes and that we will see each other as no one else sees. They said our words would be written like the paths that are worn throughout the canyons and that painted relics would be found in our whispers, enough to make bright colors in the morning of the seas exploding with the light.
Oh, Roberto, so beautiful. Brenda, how does this poem make you feel?
I love that poem. I mean, you know, I mean, it was an early poem in terms of our relationship, right? Yeah. Like, I remember that trip to the Grand Canyon with it. It captures Roberto's warmth. It captures his love of, and, you know, the way he is with the natural world. I'll never forget on that trip to the canyon, he was sitting and meditating and two deer just walked right up to him. Mm. Deer love him, right? And they come around him all the time, right? So that his like gentle spirit, and also just reminds me of that I feel truly cherished by him. Mm. I mean, really truly loved and cherished in a good way. I mean, not put on a pedestal, but always really cared for.
Oh, I love this conversation. Brenda and Roberto, thank you so much for sharing poetry with us and for sharing Woodland Pattern.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
That is the Wisconsin Poet Laureate for 2025 to 2027, Brenda Cardenas, and her poet spouse, Roberto Harrison, talking about the poet and artist-run nonprofit in Milwaukee, Woodland Pattern, that was founded in 1979. The organization is set to host its 32nd annual Poetry Marathon and Benefit on January 24th and 25th at St. Kate the Arts Hotel in Milwaukee. The event will showcase hundreds of poets from Milwaukee and the surrounding region.
Woodland Pattern has also just announced it will move from its location in Milwaukee's River West neighborhood later this year, purchasing a building in the Bayview neighborhood that previously housed The Bindery. That's a business known for book binding and printing that closed last year. The move will give Woodland Pattern roughly four times the size of its current usable space and allow it to host more than one event at a time and larger gatherings like a poetry marathon.
Want to give a shout out and extend a big congratulations to Greendale High School near Milwaukee. For the 20th consecutive year, it's won the Wisconsin School Music Association State Marching Band Championship.
And the 200-member marching band recently performed in the Tournament of Roses Parade in Pasadena, California. We'll hear from their band director on Monday.
And we want to know, do you have fond memories of being part of your school's marching band? What performance stands out to you? What was your favorite song to play as a band? Do you still keep in touch with bandmates?
Tell us your story about your high school band and what it meant to you. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Or you can call or text to share your marching band memories. That number is 888-642-0232. Again, that's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Mackenzie Crummy, Royce Padezwa, and Lauren Cox.
Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter.
Our managing producer is Tim Peterson.
And Dean Knetter is executive producer.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.